a distributed ledger, you don't hold Bitcoin. Nobody owns Bitcoin ever. It lives everywhere on every copy of the ledger. So what you actually hold is you hold a signature.
Welcome back to Bitcoin and the Bible, a weekly show for Christians who love God's word, care about sound money, and want to learn about the moral case for Bitcoin. Join us as we hold fast to God's word and hodl Bitcoin. All right, guys, we are recording today, and gosh, it's been a wonderful way to get started back with season three. Last week's episode was such an encouragement to my heart, and I know that from hearing from some of you, it's been an encouragement to you, and I'm just really pleased to see that many of you have taken the step of purchasing Bitcoin and holding on to it, despite the fact that we've seen a significant drawdown in the USD price. I think it just speaks to the reality that many of you understand that holding Bitcoin is much more than just about the value in US dollars. And guys, I know that you guys feel that way, and it encourages me to hear from each one of you how God is convicting you and encouraging you to hold fast in these difficult days. So thanks for encouraging our audience that way last week. Today's topic is responsibility and self-custody. And for a variety of reasons, it is timely and very important for our audience. By now, most of you, most of our listening audience, you probably find yourselves in one of a couple of the following categories. You probably are considering buying Bitcoin, but are still intimidated by the process. That was me a couple of years ago, and I know how it feels. The second category of listeners are those who have bought Bitcoin, but are still storing it on an exchange. And this episode is definitely for you tonight. The third category is someone who has bought Bitcoin, and you've moved it off of the exchange into a Signal signature wallet, but you're still thinking about what are the greater levels of security that I might need to put in place for myself, my family, or even the church or group that I'm a part of, or business that I'm a part of. And finally, there's a category of those out there who are listening to us that we know own and self-custody Bitcoin, and you're working to help others along this process. And this episode is definitely for you because we embrace the reality that God has put into his people, into his church, skilled men and women, and men and women who are faithful just to learn and to entrust what they know to other people. We know that that works scripturally, right? Faithful men entrust what they know to other faithful men who will continue that chain. And it works really well in the financial space as well. So with great freedom comes great responsibility. That's true in many areas of life, and it's especially true in owning Bitcoin. The benefit of holding an asset that is a bearer instrument is that you do not have to depend on anyone else to access it or to use it. The downside of that is that you bear the responsibility of protecting it. And as always, the key for you and for anyone who is embracing that responsibility is education. And that's what we hope to provide some perspective on today. And we want to do this in a really fun and engaging discussion about the realities of what self-custody is and why Christians are more prepared than anyone in God's world to take responsibility for their own freedom and use and exercise that wisely, and then in turn entrust that to others. So before we get started here, let me just remind those of you who might not have listened to every single one of our episodes, we have a website, bitcoinandthebible.com. And if you go to that website and look at the bottom of the page, there's a Bitcoin startup guide. Now, this Bitcoin startup guide was something we created last year in 2021 for you, those of you who were asking us some of the questions that we will be going back to and addressing tonight, like how do I buy Bitcoin? Once I have it, how do I custody it? And what wallets do you guys recommend? And we recognize that that information is predominantly US-centric. And we recognize that a whole bunch of you out there are not in the US and are having to kind of take our US-facing document and substitute in the exchanges and the wallet options that are available to you in your geography. So forgive us for not having all of that information, but we're going to do our best tonight to try to keep this discussion focused upon the simplicity of just simply recognizing that everyone buys Bitcoin, then they move it off of the service or exchange that they bought it to their own custody. And that will look a little different and feel a little different depending on where you live in the world, but ultimately it's the same central process. So let's get started here, Will and David. If Bitcoin is just an entry on a distributed ledger, then how can someone actually take custody over their Bitcoin? What is it that they're actually custodying or holding on to? What do you think, Will? How should we think about that?
That's a great question, Simon. And I think it's the cause of a lot of confusion among people who are just getting into Bitcoin and for actually a lot of people who've been in Bitcoin for a long time, but haven't really done the work to understand what it is they're holding. Yes, in a distributed ledger, you don't hold Bitcoin. Nobody owns Bitcoin ever. It lives everywhere on every copy of the ledger. So what you actually hold is you hold a signature. You hold a private key. That private key authenticates that you alone are the one who has the authority to move Bitcoin on the network, the Bitcoin that we would say belongs to you. When we are taking custody, what we're saying is, I want to be the one responsible to hold that signature. I want the private key. I don't want to trust that somebody else is going to sign for me. I want sole responsibility over when and how and where my Bitcoin move. That ultimately is what a private key is. It is just, we can kind of think of it as a high-tech digital wax signet ring. It is simply the mechanism by which you can stamp onto a transaction that you indeed were the one who created it.
Yeah, it's a great way to think about it. And trust me, guys, if you're out there sitting there thinking to yourself, gosh, it's so hard to understand. How am I ever going to understand this? I would just encourage you. I felt that same way when I first got into this process, and it was unnerving for me. Frankly speaking, when I first started to look at my own wallet and try to understand what a wallet did and whether or not the Bitcoin was in some sense attached to that wallet, such that if I lost that wallet, I would lose my Bitcoin. And on the flip side of that, the more time I've spent understanding it, the more freeing I've been able to get to. The knowledge that I've acquired helps me understand that that wallet, while being important though, is not the only way that I could access my Bitcoin. And it's opened my eyes to the possibilities of how the system is basically built in many ways to protect users just as much as it expects the users to protect themselves. So maybe one thing we should do from a definitional perspective is we should just again reiterate that a wallet is a term that has some bad nomenclature associated with it. When we use the term wallet, we simply are kind of pulling from our familiar bag of terms, right? When I have a wallet in my pocket, I do put money into that wallet. And if I lose my wallet, then yes, I have lost that money, right? But we're not putting Bitcoin into a wallet. A wallet is simply a way to store that signature or that private key. And there's lots of different kinds of wallets. There are wallets that live on computers, right? In a software that runs on that computer, and you can use that computer to sign transactions. There are wallets that live on mobile phones, and that's probably going to be a expanding and increasing reality. The more Bitcoin expands and across the adoption curve, you're going to see more and more people holding Bitcoin in mobile wallets. And then we obviously use the term cold wallet to refer to those small devices of various shapes and sizes made by Coldcard or Ledger or Trezor and various others that are separated from computers by some air that protect the integrity of that private seed. So let's dig in one more level here. So David, you and I came from a generation that just didn't absorb these concepts really quickly and really easily. So walk me through how your progression and understanding of custody has happened and where you still are in terms of your growth curve and accepting the reality that you're responsible for custodying your own Bitcoin.
Indeed, Simon, that was one of the risks that my wife and I, we needed to think seriously about. I think we were helped in that process in that we were hard money people already and custodied our own bullion, our own gold and silver coins. And so we had already worked through the implications of what that meant. And, that's the traditional way to do things. So you're talking about a safe and then even thinking about, okay, so we have it in a safe. Where do you put the safe? And then what about the combination? And it's a high quality safe. So there's a key and a combination. And then what if we're in a car accident and we're incapacitated? And then, how do our children access it and so forth? So we had to think about how do we and who do we distribute the extra key or keys to and the combination and all of those sorts of things. The reality, maybe the weightiness, if I could say it that way, of self-custody, we had already worked through a number of years ago. And so that made it easier. But being, of the boomer generation, the idea that it was pure digital was frightening to me. And initially, I did believe that my wallet was, that sort of looked a little bit like a memory stick. I thought that's where it was. And if I somehow pressed the wrong button and I messed that up, then it's all gone. Poof, it's gone. And so, yeah, I needed to really kind of worked through that. And, you know, Will and you both helped me along that process and enabled my wife and I to gain a further understanding in that. And we're still not cutting edge in all of those things. I'm old and cautious. And so for us, if we're air gapped, I feel like that gives us the level of security that we really need. And we have a great trust in our children and so forth. So we haven't approached multi-sig yet. We may at some point, but for now, that's kind of how we're operating.
That's a really important point you just brought up. There's no one size solution that every person in the world is going to need to consider. And I think this is also even more true when you consider not just the age and the technological familiarity of the person, but also the context in which that person is holding Bitcoin, the amount of Bitcoin that they hold, and whether they're holding it in conjunction with others as part of an institution like a church, or whether they're just holding it on behalf of themselves as a single person, as a couple with no children, as maybe a widower or a widow, right, who is not necessarily there to rely on their spouse, is going to have to rely on children or grandchildren who may or may not live close to them. So, Will, walk us through what you would say are some of the best practices that you would recommend for somebody of safeguarding just the single key if they have just a single signature wallet.
I think whether your single signature is generated by an app like Blue Wallet or whether it's generated by a cold wallet like a Cold Card or a Trezor or Ledger, when you write down your seed word, I would be appropriately paranoid about it. Remembering that if you have a single signature wallet, all someone needs is your recovery words to steal all the Bitcoin you have. So when you're writing it down, I would make sure that you're not doing it in a room with cameras. I wouldn't read my seed words aloud as I'm writing them. I know it's a habit that I have where sometimes I mumble to myself as I'm writing things. But in the age where all of our smartphones are listening 24/7 and transcribing things in data centers somewhere in the world, it's not a great idea to read it out loud. Never take a picture of it. Never upload it to your password manager. Don't put it anywhere on any computer, right? Keep it written down. Writing it on a piece of paper is good. What's much better is to get it on some metal. There are a ton of ways to do that. Everything from stamping it onto some washers and putting it on a bolt and burying it in your backyard to titanium plates that you can stamp to. There's everything under the sun, and there's options for everyone. And it's really not that expensive, $50 or less. And you can have it stamped into metal. That protects you against flood, fire. My dog ate my homework. That gives you a much greater level of security.
Right. And when you stamp it into metal, don't have somebody stamp it in for you. Right. I mean,
they may take more than the fee they charged.
Yeah, you need to do that yourself. And it's not a difficult process. That's how we did it. We stamped it into titanium plate and then stored it away in a very safe place and so forth. But we had to do that process.
Yeah, and keep in mind just some basic things, right? It is either 12 or 24 words. I know my question, someone asked this to Will the other day and he answered it really well, right? Why do you have the option of just 12 words on an app like Blue Wallet when you have 24 words if you get it through another wallet? And your answer, Will, was just that 24 words is a little bit of overkill. 12 is sufficient. And that was good for me to know too, that I can still trust the wallet that I have that has 12 words just as much as I trust the one that has 24 words. But there are tons of these questions out there and considerations. The one you just brought up, Will, is a great one, right? Don't read them out loud if you can help it. Another basic one, right? Don't put them on a copy machine and make a copy of them, right? Just recognize that copier has a computer chip memory base that could be easily reread and stolen depending on whether or not that copier is always in your possession or not, right?
So, well, even if you trade it in later or throw it in the landfill, there's some sort of storage device in it and all those images have been stored.
Yeah. So what we're encouraging you to do is to think soberly about single signature, recognizing that single signature wallets are very secure. If you make some basic decisions about how you're going to protect and redundantly protect your seed words. Now, you can go overkill, right? And we have read enough and heard enough about this that we would recommend some basic things, right? And don't get fancy and cut your seed words in half and basically put 12 of them in one spot and 12 of them in another spot, or right? Don't memorize them and basically circle words in a book or those types of things. Those sound like elegant solutions. They sound like things that nobody has ever thought of before. But given the fact that Bitcoin is 13 years old, and given the fact that there's a tremendous amount of value stored in this system, there are people out there who have figured out very elegant ways to find it. So as simple as it sounds, the dumber solution actually often produces a higher level of security.
And I think there's piggybacking on that, Simon. You don't want to have something custom that no one knows how it works, and then you get in an accident or incapacitated and your family is trying to manage your financial estate and they can't figure out what you did because your harebrained scheme is irreproducible. And I think it's also worth considering that when we're talking about a cold wallet, when we're talking about buying a hardware wallet, understand the risks and understand the cost-benefit analysis. If you have a sizable amount of Bitcoin that you're wanting to protect, it completely, totally makes sense. If someone comes to me and says, I have $110, I would not recommend them go spend $100 on a cold card and buy $10 of Bitcoin. That's silly. You should buy $110 of Bitcoin and keep it on Blue Wallet, right? Don't spend more money protecting the amount of money that you have. When you're ready, you can, and you feel comfortable, you can upgrade your security. But in the meantime, for most people, for small amounts of money, a mobile wallet is probably sufficient. And it's better for you to do something and get started than to wait and try to have it perfect in your mind and have, you know, bank vault level security, and you'll never do it. And in the meantime, you just leave your coins on an exchange.
Indeed. So before we leave this topic behind, I think we just want to briefly touch on the concept of multi-signature. We may come back to this a little bit later into the episode and detail it more, but I think it's easy for many people the first time that they hear of multi-signature to regard it as the gold standard and say, I have to get there. So briefly, just explaining multi-signature for those of you who may not have heard of it, it escalates the security by saying that instead of only requiring one key to sign a transaction, you can link several keys together in a multi-signature agreement. For example, linking three keys together in an agreement where two of those keys are required to send or sign a transaction to transmit. Now, you don't need those two keys to receive. You can always receive using the public addresses that you'll generate with that multi-signature wallet. But the idea is that you're not dependent upon one signature, which can be lost. If you have some redundancy, you could lose one and still have the other two, and thereby have the protection to be able to take those other two and to generate a new multi-signature wallet that forgot that lost or compromised wallet. And obviously the reality that you can spread those wallets out geographically if necessary to kind of protect yourself from having anyone come in and steal what you have in a single signature wallet. Now, just because multi-signature exists, and it's actually relatively easier to do than it used to be and is becoming more and more commonplace, does not mean that it is for everyone. So we'll walk us through what are the risks of multi-sig, and why should somebody who's thinking about it also consider staying in a single signature wallet?
I think you need to weigh what is it that you think you need multi-sig for. For the vast majority of people, a single signature wallet that they understand well is plenty secure. So when you introduce multi-signature, you are introducing additional complexity. You now have some number of signatures additional that you need to manage. A multi-sig could be any number of things. It could be one of two. It could be two of three. It could be three of three. It could be three of seven. Any numbers that you want. But when you do that, you are adding not only the complexity of now I have multiple seeds that I need to protect and figure out where to store and everything, but you also have to back up an additional piece of data. So for the vast majority of users, they just back up their 12 or 24 word seed, and that's sufficient. You import it into a wallet, it'll scan the most common wallet types and look for transactions, and it'll recover your funds if you needed to recover them. With multisig, let's say you back up your three private keys, you distribute them around, and one of them gets lost. You don't notice for a while, and you are still using the two keys to sign transactions and you're fine. But then your phone gets smashed and you buy a new phone and you go, oh, well, it's okay. I can recreate the wallet. I still have the two keys. I have two of three, right? Wrong. You don't have that third key anymore. And so you don't know the information about it. If you didn't back up the public key from all three of the wallets, then you're not able to recreate it. You need either all three private keys. Let's say it's a two of three, you need all three private keys or all three public keys and two of the private keys to recreate the wallet. But that's just the kind of subtle nuance that can be a gotcha down the road that maybe you weren't ready for. And if you're going to take all three keys and you're going to store them all right next to each other, how much are you really gaining? Not a whole lot. You're, you know, arguably you could mitigate, a compromised hardware vendor by having multiple different seeds on multiple different wallets. And that is a legitimate thing, but yeah, it's not this panacea. So don't rush to it. Don't feel guilty if you're on single signature and think, oh man, I know all of the coolest people are on multisig. It's not true.
I see multisig as important in situations where there's public trust involved. So as you mentioned, Simon, businesses, churches, those kinds of things. I could see it in a family situation potentially as well as a way, if Bitcoin is part of an inheritance, you could distribute to your heirs or at least, set up an arrangement that several of them need to come together in order to distribute the proceeds and something like that. So I could see certainly in a private situation that being helpful. But I think as you mentioned, William, it does increase the complexity because now I gotta think about and keep track somehow of more moving parts. So honestly, right now where I'm at, I kind of like it because I just forget about it. And I'm not selling this stuff. So it's just, it continues to come in, but it never, doesn't go out and I don't even need to access my private key.
And having multi-signature is not a new thing, right? Companies have been doing this for a long time where it takes multiple signatures on a business check for it to be valid. But you'll notice that not every business does that. And for smaller businesses, oftentimes it doesn't make sense because you sacrifice flexibility. It's the same thing with yourself and your Bitcoin wallet. Just be aware of the trade-offs.
Exactly. And so this is going to require a little bit of research and education on some of your parts. And that's why we're encouraging you towards it. We want to encourage Christians of all people to be prepared to do some work. The same way that you sit in your church each Sunday and listen to your pastor preach and then are encouraged to go home and be Bereans, to think through what your pastor has said and make sure that you agree and understand with what God's word has provided for you and that you can apply it to your life. The same thing. We want you to think through this and to take our wisdom, obviously, but do your own work and make sure that you apply it to your own context. So let's think about why Christians are so well prepared to take self-custody of their Bitcoin. I think about this in light of the fact that God has put enough of his general revelation and truth into this world that many non-Christians are able to come to these truths and embrace responsibility and freedom and security without having God's word to help them get there. But Christians of all people should be able to embrace the admonitions to personal responsibility and prudent action, because we as Christians understand that the necessity of wisdom is part of God's way of helping us to exercise the self-sovereignty, the secondary sovereignty that he gives us over the private property that we own. We talked about this a lot in season two, that God is sovereign over all of creation, and he's given us the mandate through Adam and Eve and through Noah again to exercise this dominion and this rule, and this requires that we learn how to secure and protect that which we have been given and that which we have earned in this world, whether it's money or whether it's property, it doesn't matter. This is part of who we as believers are. And the reality that sin is all around us, and it's in the hearts of those who we work with and even those whom we live with, increases this emphasis because we have to expect that men are going to be greedy, that they are thieves, that they are deceivers, that they are like their father, Satan, and that they are going to be after the things that they do not hold and that they do not own. And so living in that world has taught us that we need to take steps to provide and to protect for our families, our futures, and our churches. So how do you guys think about how Christians are prepared to take self-custody of Bitcoin?
God has given us access to his wisdom. That's, I would say, implicit in the dominion mandate and then made explicit in the Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 7. It says the primary thing of wisdom is to acquire wisdom. In other words, we need to go after this thing. It's the foundation to unlock the key of the keys to life, as it were. And so as created in the image of God and we have, as a believer, the Spirit of Christ within us, then we have the ability to tap into the wisdom of God. And with that comes the ability to think clearly about how to provide for and secure, as a steward, really, the wealth that has been entrusted to us by God.
I love that concept. We don't have a lot of these in our modern world, but when you read scripture, you realize that there were tons of needs for stewards, men who exercised authority underneath their master, and then basically handled his or his financial affairs and the affairs of his house. I think about the guy that Abraham entrusted to go back to his homeland and to find a wife for his son Isaac, right? And just imagine marrying a woman that someone else in your dad's household found for you, right? But that was the level of responsibility and authority that that man had. And he probably had to do a significant amount of work to earn that level of responsibility and authority. So stewardship is a concept that we need to embrace and use as we think about the fact that we are taking care of God's resources for him in this world, just as much as we're taking care of our own resources for our own families.
And I think that that concept of stewardship, right, it's not like they were abdicating their authority to a steward. They were entrusting the steward with their authority, but it's not an abdication of authority and responsibility. So in the same way as believers, we should not abdicate our responsibility, right? We believe in personal accountability spiritually, right? You are alone are responsible for your heart's condition before God. God judges you for your sins, not those of another. So we can and should exercise responsibility over what we're doing in all aspects of life, and in this instance, in financial decisions. So that doesn't mean we can't help one another. So as a steward is helping the household, helping them manage their wealth, so you may be skilled in these things and able to be a blessing to others, to the young, to the old, or you may find yourself on the other side of that transaction. You may be elderly, you may be younger, and you may need the help and wisdom and guidance of a steward. But don't abdicate your responsibility.
There's a wisdom economy, right? So everybody is not good at everything. We have our own areas of relative strengths, and so we bring those to the marketplace economically, and we trade with one another, and we use money to store the energy of those trades. There's a wisdom economy as well, in that I have experienced it with you guys. You know many more things than I know in the area of Bitcoin, and so we can come together, and I think I must bring something to the table because you keep inviting me back, and we're able to share together and help one another in that process. And so that's an economic transaction. We're not exchanging money in the process, but there is that system creates a greater level of economic wealth when it's the trading of goods and services. It creates a greater level of intellectual wealth and wisdom as we help one another in that process.
Indeed. And I love the reality that we are dependent beings, that God has created us both independent and dependent. As you pointed out, Will, we are independent in the sense that I cannot save you. I cannot make that decision for you as much as I would like to on behalf of my children and those around me, right? They must exercise independent decisions. But we never get there without relying upon others. There's always dependence. And that's how God has created us and designed us to be, is to be believers in community, loving and encouraging and supporting and training and helping each other and using our gifts within the body and being accountable for the reality that if you are gifted, then you are the one who's going to have to step up and help others around you.
Yeah. Earlier you referenced 2 Timothy 2:2, right? And then in the passing of the gospel where Paul tells Timothy to take these things that's been entrusted to him and pass them on to faithful men who'll be able to teach others also. And you see there Timothy's received them from Paul and so forth. There's a four generational transfer of gospel knowledge in that process. And so I think we can, by analogy, speak even to the issue of Bitcoin, is that faithful men can entrust these things to other faithful men who will be able to pass them on. And that's how the knowledge base within the Christian community with regard to this economic transition that's going on around us. And I mean, you can't opt out of it, whether you like it or you want it or you don't. It's here. It's upon us. And the church needs to be ready for it. And so those individuals who have a greater understanding, have a an obligation, I would say, a duty of Christian love to help others, brothers and sisters, to come along as well.
And that obligation goes within families too, right? A man is measured by how he cares for his family. It's part of your spiritual character, and you are responsible for your parents in their older years. It's more than just thankfulness for how they treated you when you were in diapers, right? It's your way of loving them all the way to the end and giving them the opportunity to finish well in God's world. And I think that this is an important reality for every generation to accept, that each generation will learn new skills, new information that are going to help older generations finish well. And that's what we really want to encourage many of you younger listeners to think about, is that you have parents and grandparents who are still in the world needing financial assistance. And even if it's just understanding the system that they're in, much less understanding how to hold their own Bitcoin. So let's finish with one section from Proverbs, a little bit of an extended session, but I think it captures this reality of how wisdom provides for individuals really well. Proverbs 3, 19 through 26 says, "The Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. By his knowledge, the deeps were broken up and the skies drip with dew. My son, let them not vanish from your sight. Keep sound wisdom and discretion, so they will be life to your soul and adornment to your neck. Then you will walk in your way securely and your foot will not stumble. When you lie down, you will not be afraid. When you lie down, your sleep will be sweet. Do not be afraid of sudden fear, nor of the onslaught of the wicked when it comes, for the Lord will be your confidence and will keep your foot from being caught." I believe that level of confidence and good sleep comes to Christians who exercise wisdom, both spiritually and practically. And when we apply sound wisdom and discretion to learning how to self-custody Bitcoin, God provides comfort to our way. We can sleep well at night and we can walk confidently in the day.
Amen.
Another question we should think about here is just in general, what are the benefits of self-custodying our Bitcoin? We've talked about how it obviously provides you the ability to hold your own asset and spend it whenever you want, but there's more than that. And we want to flesh out some of those benefits there. And we'll start with one scripture passage here. Proverbs 22 verse 3 is a really good one that we've talked about many times on this podcast, but we'll continue saying it because it's still true. "The prudent sees the evil and hides himself, but the naive go on and are punished for it." So what kinds of evils, guys, should we be keeping our eyes out for and looking out for so that we can hide if necessary?
Well, there is the danger of counterparty risk. If you do not hold the asset yourself, then what you hold is a promise on that asset, an IOU. And that has become our financial system. People don't hold stock certificates anymore. They don't have bearer bonds anymore. They're all held in brokerage accounts in which you have nothing but an IOU, a claim upon a claim. And even your bank account, there's no cash sitting in the vault that you deposited there that you're going to go and take back. What you have is an IOU from the bank that if you come, then they'll tell you to come back tomorrow and they'll bring your money to you. So with Bitcoin, if you leave the Bitcoin on an exchange, then what you have is an IOU from the exchange, a promise that if you ever need it or want it or to move it or whatever, that they will provide it for you. And so there is a measure of risk involved in that.
So the risk could be something as simple as, you know, the exchange has an outage and their servers go down and they're going to fix it and they'll get it back up online and they promise you the funds are safe. And you're a little worried, but you wait and a day or two later, you know, the exchange is back online and you have access to your funds again. Oh, whew, no big deal. You know, that you can survive that.
Right. But you might have missed an opportunity in the process.
Right. What if you needed to spend that Bitcoin? What if you're trying to send it to a missionary or, you know, you use your Bitcoin to tithe to your local church and, oh, I don't have access to my money. That's a bummer. It may not be the end of the world, but it's a bummer. But what happens if the exchange gets hacked? That's happened repeatedly throughout history, right? The Bitcoin network is nigh impervious to hacking, but exchanges are susceptible. Things have gotten better as time has gone by. Exchanges today are far more secure than exchanges used to be, but it's not impervious. You are delegating your security to somebody else. But even more nefarious than that, David, talk to us about 6102.
6102. Yeah, that's near and dear in the hearts and minds of the gold bugs, right? So that was FDR's executive order that he signed, whereby he made gold, and which was privately held, and the U.S. dollar, believe it or not, used to be a gold-backed dollar. You could bring it into the bank in exchange for gold, and by that executive order, and might I add here, it seems as though our government now rules by executive order, pretty near. But by that executive order, he made it illegal to hold a gold coin as a private individual. And under penalties of fines and even imprisonment, people were told to bring their gold holdings in and turn them into the bank. And they received U.S. dollars in exchange. And then, of course, they revalued the price of gold immediately after, from, I think it was $20.67 an ounce to $35 an ounce. And in the process, they debased the currency and stole a fair amount of wealth out of the American public. So that has been done, right? And it was done under the authority of the 1917 Trading with the Enemy Act. And so, I mean, who knows? We've looked around, and even today, who would have believed some of the crazy executive orders that we're seeing now? And so, so certainly for someone who holds gold bullion, then that is a real risk that you have to consider. And so they could sign an executive order and tell you that you have to exchange your Bitcoin for U.S. dollars and so forth, but they can't really compel it in the same way that they were able to with gold.
So to be clear here, what we're envisioning is a scenario, and again, we're talking about U.S. history and U.S. law, but you might not live in the U.S. and your laws might be even more amenable to the government coming in and confiscating. I know from listening to podcasts that people who live in Argentina are not surprised at all when the government basically confiscates assets out of banks. So think of the exchange that you are storing your Bitcoin on as a bank, right? I mean, that's fundamentally what they're doing. They are custodying your Bitcoin for you, and you have an account there, but there's no FDIC insurance, if that means anything anymore, right? You're really just taking the trust that you've placed into that exchange to provide for you the service that they are providing for you. And it is a service, right? They've given you some peace of mind. You don't have to worry about your wallet. You don't have to manage your private keys. You could theoretically liquidate your Bitcoin much faster and easier through an exchange. I'm not saying to you that banking has no place in our future world or our present world, and that exchanges are useless and we should get rid of them and just go to pure peer-to-peer transfer, right? There is a function to an exchange. And as Will said, they're much better than they used to be. But they are the easiest targets. If the government decided to confiscate Bitcoin, it would be difficult for them to confiscate Bitcoin held in private keys, private wallets, nigh on to impossible. But to confiscate by basically locking down an exchange and saying all of that Bitcoin that you hold, that's now ours in the government, right? That's not a reality that we should be ignoring.
Well, no, because an exchange has a president, has a CEO, has a board of directors, and has people they can arrest at 6 a.m. when you know the FBI shows up at your house and they drag you out in your underwear, and they can exert tremendous pressure on exchanges. And I'm not saying that they would, but that reality does exist out there. Whereas if you are holding it yourself, then you have the ability to move much more quickly.
And the moving much more quickly is the key here. So let's say that they pass a law saying that you must turn in your Bitcoin. The government has declared it's a national security issue and we need a strategic stockpile of Bitcoin. We're going to take your Bitcoin. We're going to compensate you in US dollars. Everyone on an exchange is instantly going to get liquidated. They're going to convert it all to US dollar and they're going to tell people, well, thanks, you know, we had to do it. If you hold your own key, you can hop on board a plane and fly out of the country with your entire net worth, with the US unable to ascertain that you just did that and unable to prevent it. That's why Executive Order 6102 worked with gold, because you can't with gold, right? With every other asset, when you try to leave the country, they will seize it. With Bitcoin, because it is a distributed global ledger, you're not taking your Bitcoin out of the country with you. Your Bitcoin is already out of the country. You're just taking your access to it.
And that's a great point. You're not smuggling your Bitcoin out of the country. Your Bitcoin doesn't exist in the country.
So if they stop you at the border and they say, are you taking any Bitcoin with you? You can, in full honesty, say, no, I'm not.
Exactly. So I think we've hit this point pretty hard, but just going to allude to the reality that we left out another benefit of keeping your Bitcoin on an exchange, if there are benefits, and that's obviously that you can earn yield, you can earn interest on it if you leave it on an exchange. We're going to defer that to a future episode that we're planning for season three, because we definitely want to take some time and walk through with you the benefits and the risks of earning yield on Bitcoin by keeping it on an exchange. But let's just summarize and think about this reality that there are many benefits to self-custodying your own Bitcoin. The no counterparty risk, we definitely talked about. You're not waiting for a bank to authorize you to spend it or to use it. Liquidity is a key thing that I think I appreciate more and more the more I hold Bitcoin, realizing that our legacy financial system is dying. And one of the evidences of that death is just how difficult it is to use your money, to have access to your money if it's not within the traditional hours and framework that the world has learned to work in for centuries, right? The 9 to 5, 9 to 4, sometimes banking hours, depending on what jurisdiction and bank time frame your bank is in, the lack of access on the weekends, right? And I'm embracing the reality that life doesn't live that way. And you may need and want to give to someone in need on a weekend and have the ability to do so with Bitcoin when you would not have had that ability unless you carried a significant amount of physical cash on your person or kept it in your home that you could then drive over to that person. And certainly no way for you to help someone who, for example, is imprisoned in Canada for violating the laws there, or heaven forbid, someone who lives overseas that you might never be able to help unless you had a digital asset like Bitcoin. But ultimately, Bitcoin self-custody provides you with security. It decreases your vulnerability to all forms of thievery, right? The simplicity of a single private key, a signature, means that you have the ability to narrow down your attack vectors and keep your individual security and your family's financial security carefully controlled with measures that you can take and educate others around you as to how to help you, whether that's your family or whether that's your friends in your church, right? So in other words, if you as a husband were traveling for business, you could entrust a certain amount of information to one of the deacons in your church to say, hey, keep an eye out for my wife. If something happens to me, then here's how to help her. So I really love and appreciate what Bitcoin has provided for me, and it just really makes me experience the blessings of God that are described in Psalm 4:8. In peace, I will both lie down and sleep, for you alone, O Lord, make me dwell in safety. When we walk in God's wisdom, we can rest securely at night. So another topic that we have to talk about is really pertinent to the market that we're looking at right now. And so there's a further benefit of self-custody that can be explained a little bit if we start to look at how the current price of Bitcoin is being affected by combinations of things. The reality that Bitcoin lives on exchanges, the function of rehypothecation, in other words, the ability for exchanges to lend at greater than 1-to-1 amounts relative to their reserves that they hold within their exchange, the trading that goes on in the derivatives market, both shorts and longs, and just the combination of those realities has led to phenomena that we've seen outside of Bitcoin and other markets. Right, this is not new to Bitcoin, but the price can be manipulated and affected by larger entities, whether those be private or public entities, that take advantage of the fact that when Bitcoin lives on exchanges, it can be more easily used to basically cause the price to go up or down based upon the whims and fancy of those who have the ability to move it through controlling these various levers. So talk to us, guys, about why and how you think we should be all the more attentive at getting our Bitcoin off of exchanges for these very reasons.
It's interesting, Simon, because we have become acclimated to, in our legacy system, various stops and if I can say financial dampening mechanisms so that the markets don't move a lot. You know, we've arrived at the place now where a 2% move in a day would be considered, you know, a large amount. And of course in Bitcoin, that's not even a flesh wound. So, and part of that is because it is a completely free market at this point. It's a bit like the Wild West. There are none of those dampening mechanisms there. And so there are a lot of people, I think, that are speculating in Bitcoin, both in long positions, right, assuming the price to go up, you know, or in short positions, betting for the price to go down, and using a lot of leverage to do that. So, you know, a relatively small amount of coins controlling a large position. And they have access to those coins, of course, because they can borrow them from the exchanges, pay the exchange an interest rate for the use of those coins in order to establish their leverage longs or their leverage shorts. And so we've just watched this up and down movement in large quantities. And effectively what that's doing is there's a lot more paper Bitcoin being bought and sold, as it were, than there are actual sats, real sats in the world exchanging hands.
If people continue to pull their coins off an exchange, there's less coins to play games with. And if an exchange runs out of coins, then everybody gets to find out who's swimming naked, right? So right now exchanges, they don't publish their reserve balances. There is a push and an effort called proof of reserves that seeks to mathematically quantify and prove that your coins actually exist, but it still requires external auditors. It still requires some amount of trust. So why would you keep your Bitcoin on an exchange, which then allows that exchange to lend it out to someone who's speculating on the price of Bitcoin, most of the time speculating to the downside? Take custody.
Agreed. And I think it's good for us to just point out here, we are free market guys. We're not saying derivatives trading shouldn't exist at all, right? We're not saying that those who are taking risks and experiencing the risk benefits and rewards should not be given that opportunity to do so. But what we are saying is that while that trading is moral from a free market perspective, it can quickly expose systemic imbalances in the system and bring down an institution and a large number of its creditors. And we've seen evidence of this happening over the past 13 years, right? When you see large spikes upwards or downwards, it's usually indicative of the fact that there is this buildup of liquidity in the derivatives market that suddenly gets flushed one direction or the other based upon just small changes in the system, but are magnified because of the amounts of leverage that are being borrowed and how that is being amplified by the system and multiple exchanges being a part of that system. So we definitely recognize that this is a reality. And as much as we would like to see Bitcoin price go up, we recognize that until the free market has a chance to decide when it will go up and how it will go up, right? That's what's going to decide it. But I think it's just a simple step to say, look, if you want to do it, something to help, get your Bitcoin off of the exchanges, because the less Bitcoin that there is available for this free market Wild West type trading, then the less likely that it will happen.
Sure. I mean, if you want to lend your Bitcoin to someone so that they can take a leveraged speculative position in Bitcoin, then you are certainly entitled to do such a thing. I think the danger, Simon, as you said, is when the exchanges begin to rehypothecate. And so now we don't have all the information we need to be able to mathematically prove these things out. But if they are, let's put it that way, if they are rehypothecating, in other words, that they are lending out more Bitcoin than they actually have, and that's what our banking system does. And so I think it's a reasonable expectation that someone or another is playing these games, then that's when somebody really gets wrecked, when you could have a system go down and innocence would end up losing.
And you might be wondering, how could that happen? How could there be more Bitcoin being lent out than an exchange actually has? And if all of this trading activity occurs on an exchange on their order books, coins aren't moving on chain. So you don't have the verification of the base underlying chain to prove, you know, which coins are owned by who. When Coinbase, which holds, you know, a couple million coins almost, is doing these things with large swings, how can you validate what's going on? And if you deposit 50 Bitcoin at Coinbase, you don't know that those coins are not being used in someone else's position as collateral. You can't verify it.
Yeah. So In summary, we just want to encourage you that in the world that we live in right now, for your safety and for your security and for your own understanding, getting your Bitcoin into your self-custody is one of the simplest, most practical steps that we could recommend to any one of you. So we've thought long and hard about this, recognizing that many of you are coming into Bitcoin and you're looking for a how-to guide, a simple set of steps that helps you get back to what you really are good at, right? Thinking, investing your mental power into the skills and giftedness that God has given you and not becoming an expert at Bitcoin and maybe not obsessing over it as much as we do individually here in our preferred space. But for those of you who are nervous about the technology and are just worried that if you take the step of bringing it off of an exchange into your own custody, that you're going to screw it up, we just like to offer some practical steps for you to be able to take. And I'll just refer back to the beginning of the episode and say, download the Bitcoin Startup Guide that we have built for you. We've test driven it a lot with some of the people around us, and they've given us some good feedback that hopefully has simplified it to a level that still is true and accurate and complete and provides you enough information, but is still accessible. And I really will encourage you that there's some actual exercises that we've built, steps that we want you to practice and try to give yourself that familiarity and confidence that you're going to need to be able to make these types of transactions an easy, normal part of your working life. So I'm going to commend that back to you. And if you have feedback for us, if there are things that our startup guide doesn't capture as well as they should, or maybe should be reworded, then by all means, bless the family of God and let us know so that we can refine it further.
BTC Sessions is a YouTube channel. Guy Ben has put together a ton of amazing content. He walks through all kinds of things. If you have a hardware wallet and you're not sure how it works, he more than likely is going to have a video explaining how to do it. If you're interested in understanding the software, Sparrow Wallet, Blue Wallet, whatever it is, he's made a video of it. Now, would caution in some of the videos, there is some profanity. So, you know, buyer beware, but I feel comfortable recommending his content. He has done an excellent job at explaining things in a really accessible way.
And we'll provide a link to that YouTube channel in the show notes for those of you who would like to get started with that. But I would wholeheartedly agree with Will. I think this captures a basic principle as well that Will preaches to me all the time. When you have a question, it's easy to just despair and say, gosh, I don't know the answer. Who should I call? When in reality, God has given you access to a majority of that information through the network devices that you have right in front of you. Just typing into your search engine, how do I do X, often provides the answers without very much work at all. So invest yourself in learning how some of those tools work. And if you're really good at that, teach others around you those basic steps as well. So just to reiterate something we talked about earlier, start with a software wallet. Software wallets are great, easy places to start as you learn the functionality of private keys. And start with a small amount of Bitcoin. Get it into a wallet like Blue Wallet, Moon Wallet, Phoenix. There's lots of really good ones out there. They're very user-friendly. The user interfaces have been refined. They're great ways to practice, make mistakes, understand what you're using and how to use it better before you push yourself to the level of getting to the point where you say, okay, I think I need to upgrade to a hardware wallet. Once you get there, hardware wallets are definitely more secure. And as David pointed out, if your priority is comfort and security, and you're worried about what an internet-connected device could be vulnerable to in the world that we currently live in, whether it's government attackers or private attackers, right? Then choosing a hardware wallet is a very straightforward step. As Will said, right? Make sure that you are measuring the cost appropriately. If the hardware wallet is $100, then make sure you have enough Bitcoin to justify that cost and not just buy Bitcoin and put it on a software wallet. But hardware wallets are remarkably simpler and easier than I thought they were going to be. I bought one, and for a while it just sat there on the shelf because I was a little afraid to open it up and try to figure it out. But the tutorials that are available online now are just so easy to follow, written step by step by step. And it, literally, if you just take some time, put yourself in a position where you have time to sit down and go through it slowly and you're not in a rush and there's no distractions and you can just read the instructions and follow them step by step, it's almost impossible to get it wrong.
And maybe we can just insert here, Simon, test it with a very small transaction first and make sure that you haven't gotten it wrong and that everything works before you turn around and try to transfer a substantial amount of money.
Yeah. And while you're doing it, yes, you want to get your coins off of an exchange, but it would be better to leave your coins on an exchange for another day or two while you...
Or a month or whatever.
While you learn how to operate your hardware or software wallet and feel comfortable, than to rush and move it to something that you don't really understand and you don't really have any more confidence. Don't have confidence because we told you to have confidence. Have confidence because you understand how it works and you're comfortable with it. Slow down. Take your time to make sure that you understand it, but don't delay forever, right? That's not licensed to put this off for the next couple of years. You know, be a Berean, figure out how these things work and get to it. And if you're struggling, BitcoinSupport.com was put together by an exchange in Canada called Bull Bitcoin that is a phenomenal exchange. And they will let you purchase some assistance, getting either yourself or you can buy a gift certificate for some relatives or friends to help you get started. They will walk you through the process of setting up your hardware wallet. They'll make sure that you understand how it works. It's kind of a white glove service for someone who really wants that individual attention of a one-on-one interaction.
Proverbs 12:26, the righteous is a guide to his neighbor, but the way of the wicked leads them astray. So we have that opportunity to help our neighbor in coming up to speed on what for many is a very scary technology.
Indeed. And it's good for us to just finish today by looking back and seeing some of the key realities and some of the steps of practical application that we've covered tonight. So as Christians, we are to pursue wisdom. This can help us to act prudently with regard to securing our personal property that God has entrusted us with. Bitcoin provides freedom for you to own something and to be able to use it wisely. And with freedom comes responsibility to work in becoming more educated and acting on your knowledge to secure your assets. Don't hide from work, embrace work. God created you to work. He's given you a mind to work. Now is the time for you to put in the work. Bitcoin self-custody can seem very intimidating at first, but speaking from our own experience, we know that it can be learned by anyone. If you do not hold the keys to your Bitcoin, you are at risk of losing it. I'll just say that directly because I want you to take it seriously and think about it, right? If you do not hold the keys, then you have a risk of losing your Bitcoin, and it is too valuable to not ascertain and evaluate that risk. By self-custodying your own Bitcoin, you can accelerate adoption. By pulling it off of exchanges, you are decreasing the available supply and therefore allowing the demand to allow that price to move upwards. And you're protecting yourself as well from some of the inherent foolishness that exists in the derivatives market right now. You are hiding yourself appropriately from that risk of fools running amok with money that you have allowed them to do so. So take small steps. Take basic steps to act and don't procrastinate, as Will reminded you. Don't put it off forever, but don't rush. Take your time. Make sure you're doing it right and encourage those around you. If you can help others in this process, this is our call to action. To all of you out there who already own Bitcoin and have held it for a great deal of time, now's the time for you to look around your church and identify the people in your family and church that you can encourage and help along the way. Don't do the work for them, right? But be there to help them do their own work and strengthen what they have. As we conclude today, we want to thank all of you for your support and encouragement. And we want to in turn encourage you to trust God, love Christ, love your neighbor, and save in Bitcoin.